Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spiders. Well, it looks like one of my podcasts irritated some people. Here's the deal. When I put these podcasts together, I try to stick to the facts. I always share my own opinions, but I'm also able to call out when my opinion is, well, an opinion. It's just the way I see things. I try to look at things very logically and, you know, compare. I try to offer both sides of arguments whenever I take up a discussion point. And sometimes people get upset. It's going to happen. It's one of those situations where people are going to hear something. They're going to not agree with you. They're angry that you have a venue for it. They're angry that you don't see eye to eye to them. And then you're going to get some pushback. So what we're talking about today is the last podcast we did, Pamphibidius versus Formictopus species, and I knew this was coming. We had some people that really enjoyed it, and we had some people that were really upset. Now, let me just make it clear to the folks that got really upset, because I think in some people's minds that because I put this podcast out and because I said that in my mind Formictopus won, but remember, at the end of it, I also said that this was just my opinion, that this is like the golden rule now, that everybody out there is going to be like, oh, Formictopus is amazing, Pamphibidius sucks, for lack of a better term. And that's not the case at all. It was just supposed to be a fun way. These are fun ways to kind of compare two different species. There's no validity to anything I say. I mean, I just try to throw it out there. In my mind, at the end of the day, the thing that pushed one over the edge is the fact that Formictopus females keep those colors. They keep those. I have gold Formictopus species. I have green Formictopus species. I have purple Formictopus species. There are blue ones out there, which unfortunately I don't have right now. My blue one turned green, but there, I love the fact that they keep the colors. And I think for a lot of people, that's a big deal, because when I was first out there looking at Pamphos, and I want to make it very, very clear, I love Pamphibidius species. I love them all. I plan on getting more Pamphos. So let's put that out there. It's not like I only have Formictopus and haven't, you know, picked up any Pamphibidius species. But I think the thing that impressed me about Formictopus is that I got the females and the females kept those pretty colors, wherein with Pamphibidius, a lot of people would show pictures of the males that are stunning. I said my Pamphibidius species Duran male was breathtaking, easily the top two. It's a battle between that and my Zanestis species Bright as far as which one was more beautiful. I wish I had better pictures to get a better comparison. They're both stunning spiders. And some of the other Pamphos, absolutely stunning spiders. But if you get a female, you're not going to have those colors. So anybody showing them off going, look at this species of Pampho is purple. Well, no. The males are purple. The females will be purple for a little while, perhaps. And then they're going to soften up to more of a brown or black, which they're still gorgeous spiders. They're huge. They're leggy. They're sleek. They're velvety. If somebody said, I don't care about the colors, I just like the look of Pamphos, no arguments on my part whatsoever. And again, I'm kind of doing this tongue-in-cheek. I don't want people to think I'm all like, heard about it. I knew it was coming. I told Billy, I go, Pampho people are going to get so mad at me. And even when I was putting the podcast together, I'll admit I was going to cheat a bit and try to find a way so that it'd just come out equal. But I thought it'd be fun, you know, to put it out there and go, this is, you know, breaking down all those different things. They're so similar in so many respects. For me, it came down to the colors. If you're not interested in the colors, it may change. So some of the feedback I got on it was interesting, to say the least. First of all, we'll go to the ones that I got on Spotify. This one's from The Jarl. This made me excited about having a Pamphibidius species Duran male. Great work on your podcast, sir. Congrats on getting a boy. They are stunning. When that guy matures for you, you're going to see one of the most beautiful spiders you've ever seen. It doesn't almost look fake. It looks fake. It looks like one of those pictures where somebody throws it up on Instagram and jacks up all the levels so the thing looks radioactive, and people go on and go, oh my God, I can't believe a spider like that exists. You don't even have to jack up the levels for this guy. I have old crummy footage that was shot on my cell phone that looked like it honestly looks like somebody put a woman's stocking over the lens. It's that grainy, and it still looks good. So yes, you're going to have a beautiful spider. And again, maybe it's the best of both worlds with Pamphibidius, because it's one of those ones that, okay, you don't get a female, but you're still just as excited about the animal you get, because it's going to be a beautiful male. Next one is from Jürgen Ludwig. Pamphos would be a shoo-in if the females had that same coloration as mature males. Would be cool to hear a similar episode comparing Theraphosa species. Cheers, Tom. Thanks so much for chiming in, Jürgen. I agree that if Pamphos if they kept the colors, that's the thing that would put it over the edge for me. Would I still love Formictopus? Yes, there's always going to be a place in my heart for Formictopus. Formictopus was the species or the genus of spider that got me out of my comfort zone where, like, remember when I first got into the hobby, I was still arachnophobic. And so when I would read things like Formictopus, it would say they are very, very ornery, nasty, big brown, nasty spiders. And somehow that attracted me to them. And not in a thrill-seeking sort of way. There was just something about it. It's like, I need to try the spider out. So as I've explained before, picked up two slings, raised them up, fell in love with the genus. They were super cheap at the time compared to Pamphos. They were like the poor man's Pamphos. So I was picking them up, every type of species I could find. And that basically started my love for Formictopus. But at the same time, I was picking up Pamphos and I love them too. So I agree. If the Pampho females kept those colors, my gosh, I can't imagine. Because they do overall, I think Pamphos have the ability to get over from species to species, they have the ability to get larger than the average Formictopus. Although I will say, like I mentioned in the previous podcast, that my Formictopus species, I've been pleasantly surprised by the size. A lot of times we throw out max sizes out there and it's like the outlier. Yes, a Theraphosa species can get to be 12 inches, but most folks are going to have one around 10 to 11, you know, something like that. Yes, B. Cancerides can supposedly reach 9 inches. Most folks are going to have one that's going to be 7 to 8. But I've had the majority of my Formictopus species have reached that 8-inch mark, which in my mind is a giant spider. I mean, an 8-inch spider is a huge spider. I have a couple of them. They're pushing 9. So, yep, I think if Pamphos had those colors and kept those colors, it would be a shoo-in for many, many people. Again, though, and the other side, the flip side of the coin, some people just aren't into the look of Pamphos. They like the fuzzier Formictopus. I've had people say that before. Like, you know what? I just like most of the Formictopus species are fuzzy. So again, it comes down to the aesthetics of the spider as well. It's not always about color. If it was always about color, people wouldn't like the earthy tone species. As it is, there are a lot of folks out there kind of snobbish in that way. Like, I don't like the spider because it's brown. I like the spider because it's tan. I happen to like the tan earthy tone combinations. They're beautiful. Next one, I'm probably going to butcher this name, Hyuna Ja-E, I think. I still think Pamphos should have won with a bunch of the snorting emoji faces. Fine, they can, like, again, it's for fun, and I think people get so upset over this, and I get it, I guess. I've looked at top 10 lists, and I think part of the problem is, anytime I do look at a top 10 list, I've always got in the back of my mind, this is one person's opinion. It's going to probably differ from mine. There's probably going to be something in there that is just thrown in for shock value. I just don't give them much credence, so I can walk away and go, well, not what I agree with, but whatever. So I get that some folks are upset by that. It's totally okay. But here it is. At the end of the day, if you like Pamphos better, awesome. Then they're your favorite. They'd win if you made your list. Unfortunately, it's mine. And at the end of the day, I came up with the all the different things we were going to measure on them. And I thought the colors put it over the edge. But it doesn't matter because it was a fun exercise. It was just kind of a way to compare two amazing spiders. So if anybody, like I think I said at some point at the end of the podcast, I don't want anybody walking away going, Tom hates Pamphos, or don't get Pamphos, or Tom said you got to get only Formictopus. No. If you're not getting Pamphos, you're missing out on amazing spiders. And again, the list was just for fun, or the comparison was just for fun. It doesn't hold any weight. I'm not the authority on this. I'm sure there are lots of people out there that raise Pamphos, that breed Pamphos, that love Pamphos, that just aren't interested in Formictopus. And I totally get that and understand. Then there was this little gem that got emailed to me. Normally, I agree with you, but in this case, you're just plain wrong. Pamphobidius are stunning spiders and have been more popular than Formictopus in the hobby for years. I couldn't tell. There was no, like, smiling emojis or anything here, so I'm going to have to take this at face value. This person was legitimately irritated by it. That's fine, but this wasn't a popularity contest. And I would add that although Pamphos, yes, years ago, Pamphos were by far the more popular genera of tarantulas. At that point, all we really had was Formictopus cancerides and Formictopus atacromatus in the hobby, which tend to be the brown or bronze ones, which aren't quite as flashy. So I would agree completely. However, I would say now if you compare it to the prices of the slings, Formictopus is caught up. So I don't even think that argument really holds any. I don't usually put in next time I do one of these comparisons, an argument about which one's more popular. I just don't think the popularity thing is the be-all, end-all. But okay, years ago, yes, I would give it to Pamphos. Nowadays, I'd say they're pretty much equal, as evidenced by the slings are very similarly priced. So I think they're both very, very popular now. When I see slings of both go up, there's certain species of each that generally people seem to be able to keep in stock. They're not as flying off the shelf, so to speak, as some of the other ones. But when the new ones, the sought-after ones come up, people buy those up very quickly. So sorry that I apparently hit a nerve, but again, this was all just in fun. I wouldn't even consider debating somebody over which one's better. That's how little I care about the topic. Like, it comes down to personal opinion. And then I had one that was kind of long, and I'm not sure. At first, I thought the person was putting me on because they were really upset. But basically said that there's no way, shape, or form that Formictopus should beat out Hamplibidius. Hamplibidius has got him beat in every single way. So I was wondering if they actually listened to the podcast where I broke down all the things that I thought. You know, I said several other things Hamplibidius beat him on. It came down to colors, whatever. And then I asked the person, I said, well, have you kept any Formictopus species? And their response was, no, I have no interest in it. Well, end of debate. You can't tell me that one's better than the other if you haven't kept both. I have kept both. I love both. I will continue to keep both. It was just a fun way, again, to compare them. So I knew this was going to happen. I told Billy, I go, at least we're going to have the first part of the podcast mapped out for next week because I know some people are going to get upset about it. But the majority of folks were cool about it. They were like, yeah, I like Pamphilus more, but I can see where you're coming from. Or I like Pamphilus more. Good. I mean, this is, again, just... And I will continue to do these because they do get a dialogue going, and that's what I love. And they're not scientific. I don't want people popping onto message groups going, well, Tom Moran said that Formictopus is better. No. Tom Moran did a comparison of the two and is obviously tainted, as Tom Moran keeps the majority of, or a lot more Formictopus, but just said that when we did the comparison, this is what it came out to be. So hopefully you guys enjoyed it, and hopefully people weren't too upset about it. Continue to chime in. I love hearing the comments about it. You know, I had some folks that said, you know, they keep both, they like them both the same. I agree. And the end of the day, I wouldn't get rid of any of my Pamphibidia species. I love them. At the end of the day, I plan on getting more. My goal is to keep a lot more than the ones I have now. So, awesome spiders. You can't lose with either of them. That should be the final message. Whatever you like, if you like big, fast-growing spiders, check out Pamphos. Check out Formictopus. You won't be disappointed. So today's topic, as you've probably realized from the heading, is a little revisiting the fossorial species. I got a really good comment. I just posted a video on YouTube this week that featured the rehousing of two Orphanacus philippinus, or the Philippine tangerine. One of the ones is the one I produced as a sling almost 4 years ago, or just over 4 years ago. I was surprised it was that long ago. And she's definitely was in need of a new home. And then we took another one that I got as a freebie. I can't remember who sent her to me. And she's put on some size, or he, I'm not sure. And that one was in a deli cup. That one needed to go into another enclosure. So I did the rehousing. And then I got an email from Brian Caprizen, I believe it's pronounced. Brian, if I mispronounce your name, I apologize. Brian's been watching my videos for a long time, always leaves comments, often humorous ones. So I know if I mispronounce his name, I'm going to hear about it. So hopefully I got it right. But anyway, Brian wrote, Tom, I've noticed that some of your fossorials go into what seem to be dedicated fossorial enclosures. Deep substrate, water dish, not much going on the surface. While others, this one included, and that was my O. philippinus, go into quote-unquote, this isn't my term, so if somebody gets upset with me, it wasn't me, semi-fossorial enclosures. I know exactly what Brian's meaning, but anytime you put semi-anything, people freak out. Anyway, moving on, exemplified by substrate that allows some burrowing, but not the extensive burrowing I've come to expect from a typical fossorial enclosure. Is this due to the issues you've had in the past with spiders burying themselves, or just burrowing deep and not coming up to the surface to eat? Or is there something about certain fossorials that make them more likely to accept and thrive in an enclosure where their burrows aren't ridiculously deep and extensive? Thanks in advance. So this is a really good question, because I read it and I'm like, man, I did make some changes here. And he brings up a very good point, and one that I think really deserves an explanation. So here's the deal with this. I have been long rethinking my setups for fossorial species, and that's mostly due to the fact that nowadays I try more to allow for both burrowing and webbing. Yes, when you put the tag fossorial on a spider, that insinuates that this is a spider that in the wild is going to burrow down nice and deep. We've done podcasts, I've done videos on the fact that you always want to give a fossorial species enough room to burrow. They need to be able to construct an adequate burrow so that they can hide. Usually it's big enough or long enough that they can get out of the light. So sometimes they'll hang out on the surface waiting for food, but a lot of times when they're not hungry or during the daytime when the light's in, they'll retreat further into the burrow. So yes, they need some room, some surface area as well, because that counts, to create an adequate burrow. I think that's incredibly important. I have long said that I think one of the reasons why back in the day people had a lot of trouble with their old world specimens, especially the old world burrowers, is because A, I think a lot of the ones coming in were wild caught, which a wild caught specimen, they tend to be much more high strung. And B, I think people weren't setting them up correctly. They would put them in something with shallow dirt. I remember back in the day seeing a lot of, for example, C. lividus that didn't have the proper room they needed to burrow, and you're going to end up with an angry spider. So the trick is to give them the room to burrow so that they can be comfortable, happy, and not pains in your butt, for lack of a better term. A spider that's allowed to hide and run, especially in old world, that's allowed to retreat and conceal itself, will be much more manageable and well-behaved than one that feels like it's constantly out in the open, that there's nowhere to go. When it feels like it's nowhere to go, when it feels like it's cornered, that's when you're going to get the defensive behaviors, the threat posturing, the stuff that people like to label as aggressive. Now, with that said, I've also noticed, as have a lot of people, there are some that just don't burrow right off the bat. There is a thought, and I wish I knew who brought this up, because somebody brought this up a while ago, and I want to credit them, but they brought up the point where they said, do you think that some of these species don't burrow because in the wild they have to burrow because of the heat? So for example, they're digging deep burrows. We'll look at like P. muticus. It comes from a very hot region. They dig deep burrows that will get them under the ground to where the temperature, I believe in the burrows, is like 68 degrees, 65 degrees. There's some magic number that the burrows get to. And they basically, that's the extent of their thermal regulation. They try to avoid the cold and they try to avoid the heat. So they dig these deep burrows, again, to get away from the harsh conditions up top. And somebody brought the idea, do you think in our collections, now that these guys have been acclimated to captivity for a while, because all it takes is, you know, one generation of captivity, things are going to start to change. And do you think it's because they don't have that heat, they don't have something to escape, that they're more comfortable setting up top? And I think that's a really good theory about why some of them just don't burrow. I found that the ones that tend to burrow quickly are the moisture dependent ones. And I found that if you do a setup where you do the bottom layers of substrate nice and moist and put drier layers on top and then put a starter burrow that goes through the dry into the moist, that will entice a lot of them to go down there and seek that moisture. However, once again, like we were talking about with the heat, if you have, like in the summer here, the humidity is quite high. It can be 70, 80% humidity in the tarantula room from the outside humidity coming in. And suddenly the tarantula doesn't need to retreat to its burrow because A, it's not too hot, and B, they're getting the humidity it wants. So is that part of it? It could be. I honestly think that's probably a big part of why some of these guys that we get, we hear about them. This is an obligate burrower. You need to give it a bunch of substrate to dig in. You set it up. You give it a starter burrow. You do everything right, and the thing doesn't burrow. And I get a lot of those questions a week. I'll get, hey, I have a P. muticus. I put it in. It's been there for a month. Hasn't burrowed. I have a C. darlingi. Hasn't burrowed. It sounds like that's just their whatever triggers that cause them to burrow apparently are either not present, they feel comfortable enough to not burrow, in which case what most of these species will do is web. So now that's where I've kind of changed my setups, because back in the day, if you look at some of my oldest spiders that are fossorial species, I would always use the tubs, sterilite tubs, because there wasn't a lot out there suitable for fossorial tarantulas that would give them enough substrate to dig in, room for substrate to dig in. So for example, my two H. gigas, my tawny baboon, or what are they, Cameroon red baboons, that's it, Cameroon red baboons. Those I originally put in sterilite containers with about 9 inches of substrate, and they both buried down deep, made deep burrows. My Chelobrachys guangxiensis, one of my older spiders, I got as a subadult female. She has always burrowed. I gave her a lot of space, but lately she's come up, done a little webbing up top. Those are ones that I put in really deep containers. I also did it with two P. muticus and ended up with one of them almost dying because they weren't getting food. So yes, in the back of my mind, what started me rethinking this was the slings. Now, does this apply to adults? No, I found that with some slings with the burrowing species, if you give them too much to dig in, you want to give them enough so they can dig, be secure, create a burrow, but not so much that they're all the way down the bottom of a 32-ounce deli cup. It's a little, you know, 3/4-inch sling. They go into premolt, they fill the thing up, and then they fill their whole den up, so they close up the entrance, and then they molt and don't come back up. And I've had this happen a few times. So yes, that started me rethinking it. But the other thing that started me rethinking it is how many of my spiders I noticed would do some digging and then pop up top and start webbing. And sometimes they would start doing one and then end up doing the other one. So the one that started this conversation was the Ophilippinus. I can speak to that because I've raised several of them. I found the majority, or all of my Ophilippinus, would burrow early on, and then they reach a stage where they're adults, and they come up, and they spend more time on the surface. So some of them, two of them, close up their burrows completely and webbed up on the surface. And the first time this happened, I had two really deep containers full of substrate, and one of them had webbed all the way up to the top of the enclosure because it really wasn't enough space. I didn't leave enough space for her to do any webbing because I thought she was going to do all burrowing. And what happened with that one is when I would open up the enclosure, she'd bolt around the thing because I'd rip away her webbing. So I started realizing that I needed to, as much as you want to give them room to dig, you also want to make sure you leave some room up top for the dirt. I ran into this issue most recently with my S. Hoffmanni. I picked up a sex female from Fear Not Tarantulas, and I set her up in one of those shoe boxes with the hinge tops, the M-Design ones, and I put in, I heard they build extensive burrows, so I wanted to give her the room to burrow. However, I put in the things about 7 1/4 inches tall. I probably put in close to 6 inches of substrate, which is a bonehead move on my part, and she dug so much that she filled the container all the way up to the top. So now when I open it, the substrate is on the like right up to the top of the surface. So that's something I need to eventually rehouse or give her more room. So that's something I started to realize. You needed room for the dirt. And when I started watching my Ophiolepinus and some of my other supposed fossorial species start to do more webbing up top, I realized that it behooved me to have a situation where I give them a choice. That's what it's about. It's not taking away their ability to burrow. It's making sure that they have the room to burrow and web up top comfortably so that you, again, don't have a defensive spider. So I think the key is to give them a choice. And I think a lot of us, when I first got into the hobby, and I mentioned three of the ones I set up years ago, I always read that the deeper substrate you could give your fossorial species, the better. And so I was constantly trying to give them like 9, 10 inches, some of these, which is great. It's not wrong. I don't want this to come across the wrong way. However, I started doing more research on them, and I found out that in the wild, and this obviously varies wildly from species to species, but in the wild, some of their dens can be a foot, 2 feet, 3 feet deep. There's been ones measured that are a meter, 2 meters deep. I believe they found P. muticus burrows, and I'm just going off the top of my head, I believe they were 20 to 30 feet worth of burrows. Now, did they go straight down the ground? No, probably not. Were they deep? Yes, a lot deeper than we have here. So I started thinking about this, and it's like, all right, we're talking about, say, a P. muticus. We're talking about a species that can dig a 30-foot burrow. Is giving them 9 inches as opposed to 6 inches of substrate really, in the grand scheme of things, that much of a difference? It's not. It's still, the trick is to give them enough space so they can adequately burrow. And you know, those of us out there, we've set up, and I've done this, where you set up a situation where you didn't give the animal enough room to burrow, and the burrows, what'll happen is they'll start to collapse, they'll have different entrances and exits, they'll fold in on themselves, and next thing you know, you got a spider that's webbing on the surface. I've done that before, unfortunately, where I just didn't give them enough. I'm not talking about not giving them enough. I'm talking about to make sure that they have enough in that enclosure that they can create, not only have a vertical incline when they go down, because a lot of them like to come up on that little, you know, vertical area and hang up there, but also give them some surface area so they can dig around. Because some of the guys, if they can't go straight down, they'll dig around the enclosure, which gives them, again, a lot more space overall to burrow. So even though it may only be after they pull the dirt up, say you give them 6 inches of substrate, they're going to pull up all that dirt. It's going to end up being 7 or 8 inches of substrate. So right there, you've already got it a little deeper than you started off with. And then they can construct sometimes. I've had ones go all the way around a 12-inch or 30.5 centimeter cube, which, right there, that's like 3 feet of burrow. So I think that's the trick, to not get hung up on that. With the P. muticus, I killed some because of it. I got these little teeny slings. I put them in 32-ounce deli cups, just like everybody said. I gave them like 6 inches of substrate. I'm like, this is perfect. They dug straight down to the bottom. They dug all the way around. Again, amazingly deep and large burrows, especially for the size of the slings. And then they sealed up their burrows, and they never came up to eat again. And that got me thinking, all right, maybe we need to give this a little more thought. So did that, yes, the sling thing, and again, this usually doesn't, I want to make this very, very clear, I haven't had this happen with an adult specimen. It's usually slings or juveniles that will, in my experience, are the ones that will get lost in those really deep things. So a really deep enclosure. So that's something that kind of got me thinking, all right, maybe a little less sometimes is better. Then, having kept some species that people would say are fossorial, For example, when I first got my P. murinus, the infamous OBT, I had read from a lot of folks, this is a fossorial spider. My first one did spend some time burrowing as a sling, as a juvenile, and then when I rehoused her, she did more webbing up top. She did like a slight burrow, a lot of webbing. And that was something that got me thinking, all right, you know what? I need to be a little more careful with what I put on the top of the enclosure. Because like Brian mentions in my older videos, if you look at the older ones with fossorial species, it was a tub of dirt, a starter burrow with cork bark over it, and a water dish. That was it. There was nothing fancy up top because that spider was going to go down. It was going to dig. It was going to bring up a bunch of dirt. So even if I put something fancy up there, it was going to get covered with dirt. And that was going to be it. But then I started seeing other behaviors. I started seeing spiders that would dig and come up to the surface. I saw some that would fill in their burrows and then suddenly start webbing. So it's about giving them a choice. So in the grand scheme of things, instead of giving the spiders 7 to 9 inches of substrate, or 18 to 23 around there, centimeters of substrate, maybe 5 or 6 inches of substrate, or 13 centimeters to 15.25 centimeters with more space up top and some anchor points, is the more prudent thing to do, because you're allowing the spider, if it burrows, the good news is that 5 to 6 inches, if it does a lot of burrowing, is going to quickly become a lot more. It's going to be closer to 8 or 9 inches when they pull up all the dirt. If it doesn't, you've got an environment up top that allows it to web and still have space. And that's also why on the newer enclosures, I tend to decorate a little more up top. It's to give them, just in case they don't burrow, to give them some artificial plants up top so that they can web under. The Ophilopinus that I rehoused last weekend, I did the YouTube video on the larger one, specimen, the female, actually went to the back corner. I put in a fake plant because I'm sick of my real plants getting destroyed. And instead of using the starter burrow that I gave her and a piece of cork bark round that I thought would make a beautiful home, she went and webbed up around there. And that's what she had been doing beforehand. In her other enclosure, she had webbed up under one of the plastic plants, webbed herself a little tunnel, and she sat in there. She was perfectly happy. So I gave her a choice. So would I have used an Exoterra Mini in the back in the day for a fossorial species? Absolutely not, because I was all about how many inches of substrate can I pack in here. However, I've since used them for other Orphanacus philippinus. I've used them for P. murinus. I've used them for M. robustum. I have an M. robustum female that has plenty of room to dig in the back. She dug a deep burrow, brought up all the substrate, killed the plant. But she's got a nice little burrow down in there. It works fine as long as you angle the substrate up. So the front of it's going to be about 4 inches of substrate, probably not enough for a larger spider to dig in. But as it goes back, it goes up to like 6 or 7 inches or so. That gives them plenty of room, especially once they start pulling stuff up. The only issue you sometimes have is obviously with the Exoterras, they have those vents on the front that you really ideally don't want covered up. So every once in a while, I have to go in there and just make sure that's cleared so we're getting some airflow through there. But again, no problems whatsoever. So in the day, wouldn't have used them. Now I find for certain specimens, and especially like the Ophilopinus, every adult female I've ever had eventually abandoned her burrow to a point, or at least closed up somewhat and did webbing up top. So that's what it comes down to, adjusting as I've spent more time in the hobby, recognizing that, yeah, sometimes even when you set up a fossorial tarantula and give it all the things a fossorial needs, deep substrate, starter burrow, the moist substrate on the bottom, drier up top, whatever it may be, sometimes they just don't go ahead. They don't dig. They want to be up top. They've chosen that. Something in their little spider brains has said, you know what, I don't need the burrow, I can do this. And we want to make sure that they can do that. They can web up top and have the room to do so. So yes, definitely made some changes in those respects. Keen eye, Brian, that's again, Brian's been watching for years. And I think it's something that does deserve an explanation because it is a change. I do find I've had some folks come on, and I always find this kind of humorous. So come on and go, how could you only give them 6 inches of substrate? That's a fossorial species. You got to give it at least 9. Again, in the grand scheme of things, for a spider that can dig a 3-foot burrow, an extra 3 inches isn't going to make that much of a difference. It's kind of like when folks will come up and they'll look at, I've had literally somebody come up and look at one of my enclosures that is 14 inches high for a piece of Lotharia species. And they said, I don't understand why you've got it in a terrestrial setup. Those guys need more height. I've got them in something that's 16 inches tall. Okay, so you gave them an extra 2 inches, and that's supposed to make a lot of world difference to a spider that in its natural habitat would be up 10, 15 feet in a tray. not following you. It kind of cracks me up. Again, we want to try to, and I think this all comes from, we want to give them as close as we can the situation that they would have in the wild, but because of space issues, because of the fact that they don't make containers for these guys that are, you know, 3-4 feet deep, I guess you could probably find something, because of the fact that if you did put, I got a funny feeling that if we were able to put a spider or tarantula into something, one of these big, say a P. muticus, into something where it could dig, let's give it 10 feet, give it 10 feet to dig, I would be very concerned that it would starve, because in the wild, there's going to be stuff in the ground. Now, if you're filling that thing with earthworms and stuff, I think it's okay. There's a lot of us now that believe that one of the problems with the P. muticus and why they were getting lost is that babies and juveniles, they would dig so deep in the wild that they would constantly come across bugs, insects, burrowing crickets, things of that nature that they could feed on without ever having the surface. They're not going to have that in somebody's house. And unless you're constantly dumping in crickets or roaches on the surface so that it constantly has something to hunt, I would worry that it wouldn't be able to find food. Again, I don't want to see anybody do an experiment like this. I know there's folks out there that love trying to experiment with tarantulas. I would not endorse it, but it is something that gets me thinking. Would they, even in that case, would it be like the sling situation where you give them so much depth that they don't bother come up? I don't know. But I do think that giving them, the important thing is, and what I want to stress out of this, yes, give them enough room to burrow. I am not in any way, shape, or form insinuating that you're skimping on the substrate so they can't burrow. No, there needs to be enough in there for your adult tarantula. If your adult tarantula is 6 inches or so, yeah, you're going to need 6 or 7 inches of substrate at some point. And a starter burrow, let it do its thing. However, I also think we need room up top for that webbing. So I figured I'd break down before we finish this one some of the species that I keep and what I've observed as far as the burrowing behavior versus the webbing up top. And I, even just making the list myself, I found it very, very interesting to see which one of these did what. So let's start off with the ones that I have that have pretty much been full fossorial from the get-go. I have 2 C. darlingi females. This one's split. I put them in 8x8x12 inch enclosures. I put in a lot of substrate because I've noticed my darlingis, they don't like to just dig one burrow. They dig like a series of burrows in there. So I wanted to give them room to kind of play around. And they are a smaller species. They're like, my biggest girl is probably pushing 4 inches maybe. So a smaller spider. But one of them dug a burrow down. She's had multiple entrances at any given time. And guess what she started doing after a while? Webbing up top. So if you go open the top of her enclosure, there's web festooning all the way up to the top of the enclosure. It's kind of like she made a dish, a web or a web bowl in the top, and she usually hangs out right in the surface. But if I open up the enclosure or take it down to feed her, she bolts down into her burrow. So that one burrowed. The other one I recently rehoused, she's done a bit of webbing up top. She has not done any digging yet. I will be curious to see if that changes. I am going to go ahead, add a little moisture to down to one of the corners, moisten up the bottom layers a little bit. Although this is one of the species that I've heard people say like it dry, I have noticed that mine will burrow to get some moisture. So just a little bit of moisture down there to see what happens. But she hasn't, and she hasn't done either yet. So I'll be curious to see if she settles in more, what happens. My Chelobrachys guangxiensis, Chinese fawn, burrower, has burrowed from day one when I put her in the Sterilite container that she's in. She burrowed immediately. She has usually at least 2 different exits or entrances, whatever you want to call it, to her burrow. Those can change. She's got, if you look at her enclosure, there's like 5 different spots where she's had an entrance, where she's sealed it up, created another one. She has been an absolute burrower from day one. My Chelobrachys fimbriatus, burrower. However, I do want to point out she webbed the snot out of the top of her enclosure. So that's one that definitely burrows. I mean, she's always in her burrow, but she brought that webbing up. And at one point, I was trying to take the top off. The webbing was stuck to the top. So there's one that, although she's in the burrow, has webbed up top as well. Selenocosmia or Phalogius crassipes, my female burrower. She's in an extra large critter keeper. I originally put about, I think about 8 inches of substrate in it. She, again, stays in her burrow at all times. I rarely see her out and about. She'll do a little webbing around the mouth of the burrow. But once again, like the Chelobrachys guangxiensis, she'll create an entrance and then close it up and create another one. So still, there's still gives them room. They obviously, in the wild, should probably dig a bigger burrow or have a different entrance somewhere else, maybe a couple feet off, whatever it may be, but she's still able to exercise those burrowing tendencies. My Afanopelma simoni, I know there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not they're truly fossorial species. I think it sounds like if they're pulled out of the wild, if you have a wild caught specimen, you're going to be more likely to get a burrower. For the folks that have raised them as slings, captive bred slings, I've heard that those are less inclined sometimes to do the burrowing. Mine is in, again, an 8x8x12 inch container. She's got about, it's good. The substrate goes about 9 inches up the container. I think I originally gave her about 6 or so. That's how much digging and burrowing she's done. She has a couple entrances and exits. She will close them off when she molts. She will change them every once in a while, like the two that I just mentioned or three I just mentioned. H. gigas, the Cameroon red baboon. Love my girls, two girls. They, unfortunately, when I set theirs up, it was back in the day when I was using mostly cocoa fiber. So what started off as like 9 inches is now probably about 6 inches or so, but they still have burrows. Both of them have burrows with an entrance and an exit. They stay in them at all time. It allows me to keep the substrate moist. I just have to be a little more diligent because obviously cocoa fiber releases moisture. It evaporates from cocoa fiber much more quickly. Those two girls have always been burrowers. The Epachypus, the stout leg baboons I have, both of them have burrows. They have the vertical holes in it. They stay in the ground at all times. However, lately I've been catching them out and about a little more often out on the surface. They've webbed up on the surface, but not up as in like webbed up the sides of the enclosure or webbed themselves a hide on the surface. It's just they've done a lot of webbing around the surface leading to their entrances and exits to their vertical burrows. And then we have my S. Hoffmanni, my... what is it, Brazilian horned baboon, something like that. One of the new world species that has a horn. Love this little girl, but she's the one I told you dug up so much dirt. She has so many tunnels. At one point, she had tunnels all the way around the bottom of the enclosure and then up to different entrances and exits. I could never find the spider because she was tucked away in some little cavern she created. So she did a ton of digging, and she is one that absolutely, I don't see her hanging out up top. She's usually in the top of her, like the entrance to her burrow, which has been kind of opened up a little bit, but she's not up on top. However, there's no room for her to be up on top. So I got to get her into something that allows for that burrowing. But I want to point out, she was one of the spiders that originally she dug out the whole enclosure, filled the entire thing with dirt all the way up to the surface, and wasn't coming up to eat. So she was one I had to open up her burrow on several occasions, drop a pre-killed item in. She went right at it. I remember one of them, she filled up her burrow. She closed it off. She was down the bottom. This is when she was pretty good size. She was probably about 3 inches at this point and did not surface to eat. I had to open it up, drop the thing in. She ate ravenously. She was super thin. I could see her molt. So that's one to keep. That's one I had to keep an eye on as far as burrowing. Oh, and I got one more to add to this. My Cotstetlana species Puebla, another one that this is one of these ones that has a thick back legs. Always it has a burrow. It always burrows. And that is another one that I put it in when I rehoused her. I thought she was bigger than she was. She was in a dram vial. I couldn't see her very well. And I rehoused her into one of those sterilite containers I have there about, I want to say 6 inches deep or so, and I put in like 5 inches or 4 inches of substrate, and she burrowed down at one point and again closed off her burrow and wasn't eating, and I was able to shine a flashlight in there, saw that her booty was quite small, saw a molt, so I carefully opened up her burrow, dropped the pre-killed cricket in there, came back a couple hours later, she ate it. But another spider that has been 100% fossorial. Not a lot of webbing at the surface. The only time she webs up is when she's going into pre-molt, and she'll web up the entrance to her burrow, but besides that, full fossorial. Now, with all of those mentioned, if I rehouse any of them, will I give them space up top? You're darn right I will. I will make sure that they have enough. I mean, these guys have shown they like to burrow, so I will give them, I'll be more inclined to give them more substrate than I normally would a fossorial species, but at the same time, I'm going to make sure they have some type of enclosure that allows for some space up top, whether it be to deposit the dirt that they pull up, or maybe someday they go, hey, you know what? I don't need to be in this deep burrow anymore. I want to be on the surface. I'm going to web some stuff up. So we want to give them that choice. But those are the ones that I have that I can say they were fossorial and they have remained fossorial. Although, again, Fimbriatus did some webbing up top as well. Now, the ones that I have that were, I was told, were fossorial that have been all over the place. First one, P. murinus. I have currently have five different ones, including my Tet. The Tet, I had some folks come on and go, man, you didn't really give that one enough room to burrow. Well, she burrowed quite a bit, has a pretty extensive burrow. I gave her about 3.5-4 inches or so. She was a smaller spider. She dug up some dirt, and she also webbed up top. So she was one of those ones that's kind of a combo. She did her burrow. It might not have been as deep as she wanted, so she did some webbing up top. My other ones, I recently rehoused four P. murinus, the orange color form, and one of them, extensive webbing up top, very shallow burrow. Lots of webbing all the way up. It's curling up, again, making that web bowl in her enclosure, and she's generally out in the open. The one next to her, decently sized deep burrow. She pulled up quite a bit of dirt, made a nice burrow for herself, but now she's webbing up around the burrow, around all the anchor points that I provided with her with. The next one over, burrow, zero webbing up top. Like, she's in her little burrow. It doesn't look like she's done any webbing up top. The fourth one, shallow burrow, no webbing up top. So there you have four spiders from the same species, same sack, four different behaviors. They got the same exact enclosure, almost the same amount of substrate, same setup, ideal, identical in the grapevines I put in. Everything is basically exactly the same, four different behaviors. So I think that's interesting to know. Then we have the Ophiolampinus, which I've talked about, that in this case, I have her right now in the Exoterra cube, the 12 by 12 by 12 or 30.5 cubed Exoterra mini, I guess it is. And she didn't bother burrowing at all. I gave her a nice spot. I even tilted it so it was kind of, the entrance was hidden. I turned the cage around and she's decided to web out in the back. And this is something I've seen from my Ophiolampinus. They will do some burrowing and then eventually abandon their burrows. H. pulchripes. I just spoke to somebody that said theirs has an extensive burrow, a little bit of webbing on the surface. When I picked up my H. pulchripes, I heard they were obligate burrows. They were burrows. Sadly, you won't see them all that much. Here is what I found. The majority of mine, the ones I've kept, I've had four. They burrowed a bit as slings. They webbed a bit up top. Right now, my old female, who's pushing, I think, maybe eight, she webbed up the entire surface of her enclosure. She had a burrow, abandoned it, filled it in, and she sits right out in the surface. My other ones, they did no burrowing, webbed up top. So there's one that's supposedly a fossorial species that, when given the opportunity, didn't bother digging. And I have no problems with their behaviors. I want to make that very, very clear. They're not like high strung. I have no issues. My female, when I open up her enclosure, will just kind of run and hide behind some plants. That's about it. And when I say run, she kind of just shuffles. She doesn't move very quickly. She's not bolting. She's not terrified. She's kind of, okay, I'm getting out of here. Finally, we have my C. marshalli, the straight horned baboon. This one is in an enclosure that I think I gave her. It's one of those acrylic enclosure. I don't know which company made it. 8x8x12 or so. And she basically dug a very intricate burrow that goes from one end of the enclosure to the other. She pops out different ends. I never know where she's going to pop out, but she also webbed the snot out of the surface. So once again, one that chose to do both. She's got her webbing, she's got her burrow, and she uses both equally. So I'm glad I gave her the space to do so, because that's a spider that is using that space. And while I'm at it, let me throw N. incy in there. I have an N. incy. That's another species that tends to do some burrowing. And mine, again, has an interesting combination of burrows and webbing. She burrowed down in quite a few spots and has a bunch of entrances and exits, and all of them are heavily webbed up top. So she, again, did both. There's webbing and there's burrowing. So glad I gave her the space. She's in the same type of enclosure that I put my C. marshalli in, the 8x8x12 one. And what is that in centimeters? 20 and a quarter, I think, around 20 and a quarter, 20 by 30.5 centimeters. So both of those I set up where I filled it a little less than halfway up with dirt substrate, but then put a lot of anchor points and stuff up top, some moss, gave her some starter burrows, and that's what they did. They burrowed and webbed. So that's what I'm seeing from a lot of these spiders now. They're supposedly fossorial. They will dig, but they will also web. So it's not so much I'm trying to be a substrate Scrooge, for lack of a better term, and not give them enough substrate to burrow. There's always enough substrate to burrow. The difference is I'm giving them room up top to also do what they need to do up top. So semi-arboreal, I don't want to use that term because people will freak out, but do we want to give them a choice of where they go? Yes, they can burrow, they can web up top. Some can do both. The options there for them. I think it's all about options. I think that's one of the things that I've changed a lot since first starting to keep spiders, is recognizing that even when thought early on was, when you have a burrowing species, give them as much substrate as you can and allow them to burrow, because that's what they're going to do. Over the years, I've realized that's not necessarily what you want to do. You want to make sure you do give them the room to burrow, but again, give them the option to do the webbing up top. Because sometimes my big thing was, if you keep them terrestrially, now you force them to do one thing, which is web. And I think this is one of the big mistakes people made early on, keeping them terrestrially, giving them, you know, shallow enclosures, not enough room for, no room to dig, not enough room for webbing up top. What I'm saying now is we need to increase both. You need to give them enough substrate to dig in, room up top the web. So that, Brian, excellent question. That's where I'm headed now. There's more. I'm definitely doing more decorating up top. You won't see any more barren enclosures for me up top when it comes to my fossorial species, because I've realized that it, back in the past, I thought they would all just automatically dig. They don't necessarily dig. So if that's the case and they don't dig, I want to make sure they have all the room they need. If they want to create a beautiful web palace on the surface, I want to make sure they have the room they need. If they want to make tunnels, I want to make sure they have the room they need if they want to do both. So that's an awesome question. I'm glad I could, I'm really glad you asked that question, because it's one that I really do think I need to explain, because they have. If you go through again and watch my old husbandry videos to now, there are changes. I think everybody as a keeper evolves. I think a lot of it comes from experience. A lot of it, you come out, all you've got when you're reading stuff online is what people say. Give them as much substrate as you can, and don't even, I remember some people going, don't even give them a starter burrow. They'll dig their own. Well, nope, there's things I found that's not true. Give them a starter burrow. Give them a couple starter burrows. Cover the starter burrows up so they have a place to hide, but give them space up top. All of it. It all works. So that's hopefully explains the whole thing, Brian, and to anybody else who is wondering. I know I've spoken to other people that have a similar mindset now where they're rethinking a bit how we do this. They're rethinking a bit how to set up an enclosure to give the spider as many different options as it needs. Because at the end of the day, it's all about making sure that that spider feels safe and secure, whether it be in the ground, whether it be in its web palace, whether it be both, whatever it may be. We want that spider to not have those defensive behaviors so that we're not putting the keeper and the spider in danger. It's all about spider comfort here. And I found that that's a good way for me to make sure the spider is comfortable regardless of the situation, regardless of what it wants to do. So that will do it for this one. Thanks again to Brian for the amazing question. That was great. And it was funny because I was trying to put together our podcast topics yesterday and that question popped up. I'm like, well, there it is. That's a good one. And that might be something I have to cover in a video too, because I think folks that watch my videos deserve an explanation of why I've tweaked things out a little bit, why I've changed things. The other thing I do want to mention about the substrate depth is that one of the other reasons we want to make sure that we put enough substrate in there is the moisture-dependent species, like Coelobrachia species, you want some moisture. It makes it easier to maintain those moisture levels if you have deeper substrate. So that's another thing that can't be overlooked, and another reason why I won't skimp too much on it. We don't want it to be too shallow. We want to make sure the spider can create a burrow. We also want to make sure that there's room to absorb that water. I have had situations where I didn't put enough substrate in. I thought I did. The spider dug up everything on the bottom, brought it up to the top, and then when I add water, all it does is puddle in the bottom. That you don't want. You want to make sure there's enough dirt in there that you're able to moisten down part of it so the spider can go down and get the moisture level you need. But that will do it for this one. Obviously, if you want to check out the video on YouTube where I rehouse the Ophiolepinus to see what I put them into, the setup, it'll probably help explain more what Brian was seeing, because it does, for a first glance, it doesn't look like a true fossorial setup, but there is enough room for that spider to burrow if it wants to. It just doesn't want to at the moment. The other one, I will say, and I should point this out, the other one that I rehoused, a smaller one, did go into its burrow, and I came up this morning and there was some dirt pulled out of it. So that one looks like it will continue to burrow, and it will have enough room to burrow if it wants. Again, if it decides it doesn't want the burrow anymore, there'll be some room up top for it. That'll do it for me. As always, you can find me on thomasbigspiders.com, Thomas Big Spiders, the podcast. You can leave comments on Spotify. A lot of folks leaving them there, which is awesome. It's very easy for me to go and approve them. I'm just not able to respond. Guys, stay safe. We'll catch you all next time.